All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio, and I thought we'd go into a bit of a discussion with our presenter Leo, who actually follows Eastern European politics and is also someone from Eastern kind of European background as well. About the kind of the elections that actually took place in Serbia on, I guess, April 4th. I guess maybe to kind of start off, I guess, this discussion. I mean, Leo, do you want to sort of give us, you know, for our listeners, because a lot of our listeners might not necessarily know that much about politics in Serbia, because I guess one of the things about Eastern Europe is Eastern Europe tends to be, you know, tends to be one of the countries that is probably least covered in even in left-wing kind of media. Often, you know, the main sort of countries that seem to get dominated are those Western Europe, and we often don't hear much about Eastern Europe. So I guess, yeah, want to hear a bit of a background on Serbian politics to take us through to the implications of the election.
Yeah, sure. So the elections that happened a couple of weeks ago now, it's a little bit of a niche subject, both presidential and parliamentary election that happened in Serbia. But as you mentioned, southeastern European politics isn't really, doesn't have much sort of coverage. So it's always good to sort of dive into these topics a bit. And as we get to later, sort of broader implications for, you know, the wider European context itself. But look, you can sort of talk about Serbian and broader Balkan and ex-Yugoslav politics historically as much as you can, but perhaps, you know, a good sort of starting space for Serbian politics in general is the collapse of Yugoslavia, which, you know, was marred by ethnic conflicts. I won't sort of get into the causes there, but, a lot of unresolved sort of ethnic minority issues, lots of nationalism stemming up from the Serbian side, Slobodan Milošević, from the Croatian side, Franjo Tuđman, and then Bosniaks with Alija Izetbegović. But on the Serbian context especially, Milošević sort of came from the rump of the former Serbian section of the Communist Party of Yugoslavia, transformed into the Socialist Party of Serbia, and sort of synthesized basically Serbian nationalism with this sort of almost greater Serbian Yugoslav nationalism, seeking to integrate all these sort of republics, which at this point wanted to leave Yugoslavia with sort of a greater sort of Serbia tinge to it. And, this was a system that was, had a lot of corruption, a lot of authoritarianism. At that time, Serbia was also hit by very devastating sanctions. And then after the war in Kosovo, it was also bombarded in 1999. So a lot of sort of trouble emerged for Milošević, who was toppled in 2000. You then had a sort of united opposition from various sort of centre-right to centrist forces coming out of that. People like Zoran Đinđić, who was assassinated a couple of years after. And that's the sort of prevailing sort of tension that's been in sort of Serbian politics since the collapse of Yugoslavia. It's been this sort of almost false choice between the sort of so-called communists, who, you know, in reality were really nationalists from the Milošević side, sort of centrists who were aligned with the sort of Democratic Party, and then you had even further ultra-nationalists with the likes of Vojislav Šešelj. But basically, to sort of recap, the past sort of 10 years, the current president of Serbia, who's also served as prime minister, defense minister, and previously information minister, he left the ultra-nationalist Serbian Radical Party, formed his own party, the Serbian Progressive Party, which is a bit of a misleading name. It's sort of pretty sort of centre-right, sort of populist, liberal conservative party, seeks to balance east and west, and he's sort of found the perfect sort of equation, appealing to both quite a significant proportion of the population who, you know, are sympathetic to Russia, but also trying to integrate Serbia into the EU. And yeah, he's been in power in various coalitions for the past sort of decade. He's really strengthened his power, won the presidential election with something like 60 to 40% of the vote. And then his sort of party in the parliamentary elections will have another big sort of majority after taking about 40% of the vote. So We'll talk about, more about maybe the sort of implications about, you know, foreign relations and that sort of stuff. But yeah, he's very much consolidated power. He rules it through the media, through various oligarchs who, you know, emerged after the privatizations. And yeah, they're the sort of elite that run this state, unfortunately, at this point in time.
So in terms of these kind of elections, I guess the kind of result is the dominant sort of party basically won kind of again, which is, I guess, the socialist sort of party.
Not quite. The Progressive Party.
Which the Progressive is Party. The Progressive Party. And I guess, what were some of the other sort of parties that sort of ran? Even smaller minor parties, like what was the sort of different visions that were sort of contested in terms of this election?
Yeah, just to give a sort of broad overview, most of the opposition boycotted the last elections because of, you know, various corruption scandals. They didn't believe the election, you know, results to be valid. So this is the first time it's only been 2 years, but in 2 years that we've had the opposition participate. The Serbian Progressive Party, the one led by President Vučić, contested. They were the winners. They had sort of a big coalition around them of various populist sort of parties. Their coalition partner, Milošević's former party, the Socialist Party of Serbia, now led by Ivan Dačić, also contested, once again, ostensibly sort of centre-left, left-wing, trying to use the sort of imagery of the socialist past, but in reality, once again, pretty nationalist, pretty populist on a lot of these big questions. The opposition itself, there was sort of numerous sort of strands. Some of the opposition formed an alliance, consisting of, you know, broadly centre to centre-right parties. And then there were more sort of right-wing opposition figures, ranging from more sort of religiously influenced to more just outright nationalist, and a couple of small sort of leftish sort of parties that sort of emerged in the wake of some of the popular protests you might or might not be familiar with, especially with some of the Rio Tinto dealings that have had with the Serbian government. But just to sort of provide a bit of analysis on two main things, just in terms of the far right, the Serbian Radical Party that was led by Šešelj, that was a big sort of force in the 90s, that's almost really collapsed. The far-right vote is splintered into all these different, you know, sort of smaller forces and channeled back into the Progressive Party. And also the opposition. This has been a sort of perennial issue for Serbian oppositions. The sort of current alliance, united sort of alliance that contested the election, it was very much done to parallel the original sort of DOS, the Democratic Opposition of Serbia, that ran in the 2000s to topple Milošević. And it's basically a big tent, and that's been one of the big sort of things. Should the Serbian opposition work with, sort of more right-wing forces in order to provide a sort of big tent platform to overthrow the current corrupt government? But then, of course, the problem from a left-wing sort of socialist perspective is what next? And I think one of the reasons that Vučić came to power is because even once Milošević was toppled, the government privatized a lot of state-run firms, and, you know, things didn't really get better despite that.
Yeah, and I guess I want to go into a bit of the... We can go into a bit of the kind of implications of the results for broader politics in Eastern Europe soon, but I guess a question that needs to be kind of asked as well is, I mean, although it is obviously it's often difficult for a lot of countries within the Eastern kind of European kind of context because of, you know, the whole fall of the Soviet Union, etc. But I guess the question kind of is raised, I guess, what is the actual left sort of position, like the left perspectives that's being put on left forces that exist in Serbia, and in, especially in the context of this election? Because I guess it doesn't seem clear to me that, you know, neither the opposition or the ruling party fit within a sort of standard sort of left-right sort of framework. In fact, they both come off as capitalist parties at the end of the day from your sort of discussion that you've sort of linked. But maybe you might be able to enlighten us a bit more on what is actually the left sort of positioning in terms of this left, and what is the left voice?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. And I think it's a sort of phenomenon that we see across a lot of former socialist states in sort of central, southeastern and eastern Europe, where we have a political system that doesn't, you know, have a lot of history of democratic political culture, and you see parties that don't really represent ordinary sort of interests or, you know, the sort of ideologies that we see in the West. A lot of them come through sort of oligarch sort of powers, like we see sort of in Ukraine. But in Serbia, for instance, the problem is that the sort of socialist or left-wing name is tarnished by the former sort of communist past and by current parties trying to claim that sort of history, like the Socialist Party does in Serbia. They use the iconography of, you know, former Yugoslav sort of sayings, mottos. They even had the grandson of Josip Broz Tito, the former president of Yugoslavia, run on like the list of the Socialist Party of Serbia a couple of years. So they're very much trying to sort of get this nostalgia going in terms of left-wing policies. But unfortunately, you know, these aren't really left-wing politics, you know, by name only. In terms of actual credible left-wing opposition, most of it has come from the streets. Belgrade had sort of street protests in the past few years in response to a whole lot of stuff, environmental issues, corruption, sort of called one of 5 million. And we've seen similar manifestations across the Balkans, in Bosnia-Herzegovina about sort of police failings, about a missing sort of boy, similar stuff in Croatia. A lot of environmental concerns as well. Rio Tinto tried to expand to Serbia and do all sorts of deals in the forestry sort of sector with the government, and there was a lot of popular mobilization against that. So, yeah, it's hard not to be cynical, but the left-wing forces that do sort of come, they are predominantly on the streets, and as you observe, there is quite a sort of strengthened right-wing and a sort of centrist liberal opposition that provides the main opposition, and then some far-right elements as well there.
Yeah. And I guess going into, I guess, some of the kind of results is what has been the kind of implications of these, of the election for broader politics in Eastern Europe?
Yeah, I think just the scale, I mean, Vučić's victory was always sort of expected, but just the scale of it, despite, you know, emboldened opposition, you know, we thought with the sort of stuff about Rio Tinto, about different sort of issues that were happening, that they might make more of a dent. I think it's a bit disappointing for the left in the Balkans in general, because it undermines this sort of any hope that it's very difficult to get these entrenched, very entrenched sort of leaders out. You know, once they're in rule for a couple of years, it slowly becomes decades. And once they take over, you know, state media, and all these sort of big firms, it becomes very difficult to remove them. So I think that's the biggest sort of implication for Eastern Europe. But I guess we'll touch on that with the next question about sort of Ukraine. It does have sort of some geopolitical significance as well.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's always got to be the most interesting, because everyone's obviously following the war in Ukraine, although in some sad way it's also been normalised in a certain degree. In fact, you know, I remember kind of like the time when we followed every sort of regular kind of event. Now it's sort of like, yeah, this is just something that's happening in the background. Yeah, life goes on kind of thing. That's been a bit of a tragedy, actually, in some sense. But I guess it's kind of, it would be interesting to know, how have the events in Ukraine actually shaped politics in the region as it's currently happening right now?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, especially, you know, as we looked, you know, sort of in horror, that's what's happening in Ukraine. You know, in some sense, we are still, you know, protected just by the distance of how far away from the conflict. But, you know, for a lot of Eastern and Southeastern European states, they are pretty close to what's happening in Ukraine. So it definitely had an impact on the election. I think Vučić sort of campaigned on the problems in Ukraine as positioning himself as, you know, a safe incumbent for all this turbulence. But the sort of analysis there is very interesting, because a large section of the Serbian population and Serbs in general are supportive of Russia. You know, there's a long history there of, you know, the two sort of predominantly Orthodox states supporting each other. You know, Russia likes to see itself, rightly or wrongly, and, you know, correctly or incorrectly, as sort of bulwark to the West, Western imperialism, and Serbia and Serbs sometimes tend to sort of idealize that role that, you know, Russia plays in standing up for the West. So there's a lot of Russophiles in Serbia. But one thing that Vučić has done very well, you know, probably to serve his own sort of capitalist interests in keeping, you know, both sort of sets of markets open, is to negotiate a very sort of tricky thing between the West and the East, and keeping, you know, decent relations with Russia and China, especially more so, especially around the vaccines at the early stages of the pandemic. Serbia was quite sort of quick in vaccinating its population, and the West also still seeking to join the EU and finding a sort of mid-balance. So I think Vučić sort of recognized that, you know, it's and Serbia in the UN sort of condemned Russia's actions. They voted against, they voted for the sort of motion that passed the UN General Assembly. So they've definitely condemned it, but they've also been hesitant for things like sanctions and other things. So I think it's definitely a tightrope for Serbian sort of politicians. But I think Vučić, you know, without giving him too much credit, has provided a bit of an example for what, you know, Serbia is an officially neutral country enshrined in its constitution, a bit of a model for what other possibly Central and Eastern European states could do, recognizing that, you know, neither East nor West is the best. And yeah, there's a long history of sort of non-alignment in Yugoslavia, and perhaps, you know, thinking about geopolitics in that sort of sense could be useful in the future.
Yeah, well, this has been a very good kind of discussion, Leo, and I guess I've learned quite a bit about politics in Serbia. And I guess what can you, I guess any kind of final kind of comments to kind of conclude this discussion, I guess, we're having?
Not particularly. The Balkans, I was there in December pretty recently, and a lot of the region is still devastated by the impacts of the war in the 90s. There's still a lot of nationalism, still a lot of problems. But yeah, like in Australia, like anywhere else, you know, real change is going to happen through people power. And yeah, there's a big problem with demographics, a lot of young people leaving. But yeah, if there can be some sort of big mobilizations and incorporating all different sectors of society, that's something to look forward to.